to remember and accept. I vow to taste the truth that Tathagata's words.
Good evening, everybody. Things that I'd like to share with you tonight, and I'm hoping to be brief and have some discussion time. And I thought I'm hoping the result of my miscellaneous remarks, I'm hoping will be to bring up the practice coming up of a practice period. Because, maybe you all do know, we have every year a 6-week period in the winter of more something practice. I was going to say more intensive, but that it might not be more intensive. I don't know what the right adjective will be for you. But more something. And in a monastic establishment, it would be pretty obvious to everyone what to do, because they would write a schedule that would be more rigorous than the usual schedule, with more meditation and study and classes and so on. And we do that to a limited extent. But basically, we recognize that most of us don't have, it wouldn't be possible for us to all, come to the Dharma Hall 2 or 3 times more often, or do a whole bunch more practice together. And so for us, the challenge of practice period is to sort out for ourselves, what should that time be for me? How should I work with that in my home practice, in my coming to the Dharma Hall, and just in how I approach my day, and approach each moment of my life during those 6 weeks. So I'm hoping to sort of bring up the topic of intensive practice, or see, any word you use, it's easy to sort of overdo, right? More serious practice, more committed practice, more gentle practice, more firm practice, I don't know what it'll be. And so I want to update you about miscellaneous things, and then hopefully have a discussion to kind of prepare us a little bit so we can be thinking about this. Because next Thursday we'll have the opening ceremony, so a week from tomorrow, I think. Yeah, a week from tomorrow. You ready for this? So, in no particular order, I wanted to mention a practice I'm doing for practice period, which is that I've started an 8-week apprenticeship in Seattle, going to a mindfulness-based stress reduction class for veterans at the Veterans Administration Hospital on Beacon Hill, which is like South Seattle, too. It's really far. Seattle's not just one place, it turns out. They're like pretty spread out. And I've only been one time. The classes are every Thursday morning. And so my plan, which I hope I can sustain, is to go down on Wednesday night. So if I book out of here the second we're done, that's why. I won't really want to chat. And so I went to one class, and the people who come to the class are, most of them are veterans. Some of them are the staff members. A few of them are staff members of the VA. Almost all of them are veterans. And about half of them are exactly what you would imagine. Big guys, in their maybe middle 60s, with tattoos and motorcycles. And we shared a little bit of our stories of why we were coming to the class, and it was heartbreaking to listen to these big guys, you know. But it was pretty much what you would expect, you know, that they'd been through a lot. Several of them said they had us do things in the military that nobody should have to do. They have chronic pain, some of them pretty constantly. And mostly life just feels like too much. Life is a little too intense all the time. And they're really, and they've tried a lot of things, you know, official medication and unofficial medication and everything in between. And that these guys are really willing to try meditation if they think it might help. And mindfulness-based stress reduction, MBSR, it's essentially meditation in different forms, pretty simple, with an emphasis on mindfulness of the body. And anyway, so these guys were pretty much what you would expect, about half of them. One thing I learned which really shifted my attitude is the motorcycle thing. I've always been a little scornful of these big guys zooming around in their big motorcycles. Maybe you have too. But one of the questions that we asked them was, when are you relaxed? When's the time that you are relaxed? Several of them said, I don't know if I'm ever relaxed. But several of them also said, the one time I'm relaxed is zooming down a two-lane highway on my shovel nose or something. They had terms, you know, on their motorcycles. That there's a feeling of intensity and control and freedom to them riding their big motorcycles. That riding their big motorcycle is one of the few times that they have some relief from suffering. So anyway, I want to mention that because now I'm much more sympathetic to motorcycles. Like, oh. But the other half of the people in the class were not what you would expect. There were quite a few were women. Many were younger. Several have received injuries. Several of them are quite mild-mannered looking people, but when they spoke, you could tell that they were wound up inside, tighter than, you know, like a really tight spring. And several of them said, it's unusual for me to say anything out loud about how I'm feeling, but I'm doing it anyway. And I'm usually, like, too angry to do that. So anyway, that's one of my practice period jobs. And also several of them said they've actually have been interested in meditation for quite a while, but they've always been sort of intimidated and afraid to do it. So these do not look like the kind of, they don't look like the kind of people that usually see come into meditation halls. So it seems really good to that they're developing a way to bring meditation, bring this sense of mindfulness and presence, acceptance, you know, spaciousness to people where they are. You know, they don't have to come here. We can go there to where they are. But a lot of what doing this class reminds me of, and also another time when I got to teach meditation to the Christians at Samish Island, and another time teaching meditation to the people with multiple sclerosis that Nancy did too. I'm impressed in a very deep way with how powerfully healing simple awareness, simple mindfulness of what's happening right now, just breathing, just being quiet. It's so simple, you know, and I think as we get into the religion business, we get a little busy with all the other things. And it's easy to lose contact with that sort of basic, powerful simplicity of simple mindfulness. And this is really something that we can all reinvestigate and reaffirm and re-explore during practice period. You know, what if we were more able to slow down a little bit and just be present and see what that is? Not worrying about things as much, not trying to figure things out as much, not trying to do things as much, but just practicing being. So anyway, working with these different groups has given me a lot more appreciation, because I can see, you know, the difference, you know, 1 hour, you know, 2 hours of practice, and people who have never been anywhere near a meditation hall are like really feeling some benefit, really shifting. And then I also, another thing I wanted to mention was, I don't know why I'm doing so many things at once, but as I went down to the Seattle Soto Zen group on Sunday, and they invited me to go down and give the Dharma talk there. And it was really lovely. They meet in a very nice Aikido dojo, kind of just across the ship canal from Fremont, so it's pretty central, pretty easy to get to, and there's parking. And it's at a pretty easy time. It's Sundays at 9:30. So if you're ever in Seattle, it's well worth going. The forum is pretty much exactly what we're doing. It's a different group of people. Some little differences. But it really is so encouraging, you know. It's so, I don't know. It gives you a sense of the sort of, it gives you more confidence, I think, in practice. To go to other practice places and say, oh, it's not just like some weird sort of thing that we're doing in this particular location in Bellingham, you know. It's something much universal and much broader. So I recommend visiting them and the group in Vancouver. And there are groups sort of springing up everywhere within the sort of everyday Zen family style. Laurel Vogel's trying to start a little group on Whidbey Island, and there's a group on Salt Spring, like lots of islands, a group on Salt Spring Island, a group on Cortez Island, far to the north. And you'll meet some of the people from Seattle, I think. I was inviting them to come, and many of them said they wanted to come here, and hopefully we can start coming there. And that's another way that we strengthen and encourage each other. And you'll meet the priest who's working with them, Echo Jeff Kelly, who has been up here before. And was at Samish last year. Because for one thing, I invited him to come to practice period, and he's going to come to the one-day Sesshin on February 13th. And I've been talking to Jeff about some collaborations, too. Maybe we'll do Sesshin together with the Seattle guys. That'll be fun. There are a lot of things we can do. And when I was there, I was trying to figure out what to say, you know, I'm always not, it's hard to figure out what to say in a Dharma talk. And Jeff said that they had been studying Bodhidharma, famous, you know, iconic, sort of mythical first ancestor of Zen in China. And these early ancestors of Zen, I've always had a hard time relating to them. Maybe you have too. They're sort of so iconic, you know, and so intense, and so, it's at first they seem to be sort of so one-dimensional. Just some sort of a screen under which somebody projected some sort of intense, rigorous idea of Zen. And so I thought I would reinvestigate a little bit Bodhidharma and his successor, Weka. And some of this material I put in the responding gate email that you might have already seen. I sent it today. And so as part of my talk, I investigated a little bit some stories about Bodhidharma and Weka to see if I could, you know, was there something more to this than I had understood before? Because, you know, what's obvious right away about these stories, like I say, is their sort of intensity of their enthusiasm for practice. So I don't know if you know these stories, but there are all kinds of stories about how intense Bodhidharma was. And then Weka, his student, who already had been practicing, I didn't realize this, had already been practicing for quite a while, 10 or 12 years, and had important enlightenment experiences and visions. And, you know, like we would be happy to have Weka, before he met Bodhidharma, show up and teach us. You know, that would be great, you know. So I didn't realize that. So, but then through a sort of combination of visions and advice from his teachers, Weka heads down to Bodhidharma's place, Shaolin Temple, which I think is like sort of a shack on the edge of a cliff or something, you know. I don't think it was a very impressive place. with a cave in back. And then the story is that he knocked on the door, and Bodhidharma wouldn't let him in. And then the backstory you have to remember with these is this probably, he probably had walked for a few weeks to get there. Because China's a big place, you know, and there's no transport. And it was December. So Wicca just stood there, and there's a tradition still in Zen monasteries of doing this. What you do when you're going to enter training at a formal Zen training monastery is you go to the, they have like a han, like we do. You go up to the han, you whack it like really hard, 3 times I think, whack, whack, whack. And then you just stand there, you know, and wait. And they ignore you for a couple hours or a day maybe. And then eventually somebody shows up and takes you to the waiting room, and then there's a whole other process that you do that takes a while. But yeah, you just stand there. You don't like say, excuse me, you know. You don't look around, you know. You don't like call ahead or, you know, have your credit card ready or anything like that. So Waco's just standing there in the depth of winter. And of course it starts snowing. And so he just stands there all night as it snows until he's buried to his waist, you know. So this is like the incredible enthusiasm these guys have, you know. And then it gets worse. And then Bodhidharma consents to talk to him. Like basically, you know, okay, so what do you want again, you know, kind of thing. And Wicca explains he wants to study the way. And Bodhidharma says something along the lines of, even if I told you, you wouldn't understand it. You know, shuts the door again. So then there happened to be a very sharp sword lying around. I don't know why there's always a sharp sword, right? Or lying around when you need it, but
in the snow.
In the snow, yeah. Wouldn't be usual for a monk to have a sharp sword, I don't think, but who knows? Maybe he had it with him. And then the story, which we can take metaphorically, is he chops off his left arm. Says it's his left arm. And then Bodhidharma says, oh, okay. You're actually serious. Okay, well, come on in. You can sleep over there, you know. You can start training. Yeah. And of course, you know, probably wouldn't survive that. But even though that is probably just a metaphor, monks and nuns have until up to the present day, in some small but steady numbers, practiced bodily mutilation as an aesthetic practice, usually cutting off a finger. And, you know, I don't know anyone directly, but I know people who have done this practice, if you want to call it that. So religion is pretty strange, isn't it? Even one based on, you know, the relief of suffering can inspire some extreme action. But then I kept reading and thinking about this, and I realized there's more to the stories than just sort of extreme practice. So here's two teachings that are recorded between Bodhidharma and Wicca. After 8 years of practice, you know, so this is like full-time, you know, sitting a good chunk of the day, studying, you know, work. Probably they had to beg for their food. It's not really recorded how they lived exactly. Maybe people from the nearby village brought them offerings. But probably pretty simple, intense practice. 8 years into this, Wicca asked Bodhidharma, can I hear about the seal of truth of the Buddhas? And Bodhidharma answers, the seal of truth of the Buddhas is not received from another. The seal of the truth of the Buddhas is not received from another. It's really sort of a powerful, sort of humble interaction, isn't it? First is Wicca just having the courage to ask that question. You know, after 8 years of serious study, you know, wouldn't you be a little embarrassed to say, you know, sort of, so what does this mean again? Yeah, what's the point of all of this? I think I missed that somehow. You know. I think we would mostly just be too embarrassed, and you know, we'd probably just sort of slink off in the night or just keep slugging along or something and hope that we'd figure it out. So very humble on the part of Weka to ask that question. What does this mean? And Bodhidharma's reply at first might seem like not too helpful in a way. I'm not going to tell you. But actually, if you think about it, it's really also quite humble and deeply supportive of his student. You can't get this from somewhere else, from somewhere outside. Rely on your own heart. And I'm here. I'm here to support you. But I can't solve this for you. I can't tell you any sort of magic answers. Because you got to surround this exchange with this context of living intimately together for 8 years. Can I hear about the seal of truth of the Buddhas? The seal of truth of the Buddhas is not received from another. And it reminds me, this is a famous sort of attitude in Buddhadharma from the Buddha's day on, and it also reminds me, Dogen has a wonderful expression that the family jewels don't enter through the front gate. So don't be looking sort of out there somewhere for the family jewels. You had them all along. You just forgot, didn't notice what they looked like. And there's many allegorical stories in Buddhism of that, making that point. But, you know, there's lots of ways that you can understand or misunderstand or think about these kinds of teachings and exchanges. I think it's a misreading to think that this kind of exchange means the teacher has nothing to offer and that it's all on the student. That there's an implied, it's like I'm saying, there's a sort of implied intimacy and just unlimited support, unconditional support in the presence and kindness of a good teacher and a good sangha. To have people in your life who are willing to just be there, even though they don't have any answers for you, to just be there steadily and patiently, ready to help, no matter what, no matter who you are, what you think you understand or what you don't think you understand. So then I'm starting to realize these early Zen stories have a lot of that in them, intimacy and support. And another time, Bodhidharma gave Weka this teaching on how to practice. Bodhidharma instructed Weka, outwardly cease all involvements, inwardly have no coughing or sighing in the mind. With your mind like a wall, you can enter the way. Outwardly cease all involvements. Inwardly have no coughing or sighing in the mind. With your mind like a wall, you can enter the way. And I just love that little thing about coughing and sighing. Don't you know what? Don't you hear what he's saying there? That's kind of sense of, or you know, which can be very subtle, you know. These subtle sort of layers of resistance and avoidance of what's actually happening. And in the context of formal practice, they can be quite obvious because you actually do that. You know, the first period or two of Zazen is fun, you know. But then the third or the fourth one, yeah, there can be a little coughing and sighing in the mind. A little sort of, okay, I guess, you know, a little complaint. But the first half is important too. Don't overdo it. in your interactions with the external world. Don't get too busy. Don't get too crazy. You have some control there over how involved you are. And we might think, yeah, but they were monks and, you know, worked for them, but I'm a little too busy for that. But I think all of us have some, a little more control and a little more choice than we think we do, both in the actual sort of apparent circumstances of our life and in the ways in which we engage and get involved with those circumstances. And that might be something also to study during practice period. You probably still have to go to work just as much during those 6 weeks. But it might be you can engage with those circumstances in a different way, with the quality of ceasing, the quality of spaciousness. So I thought that was sort of very loving advice from Bodhidharma to Weka. Here's one more, one last one. And if you want to read these again, they're all in your email. One time, and this relates a little bit to our shuso, I guess, here, because it's about hiking, the teaching about hiking. One time, Weka climbed up Few House's peak with Bodhidharma. Bodhidharma asked, "Where are we going?" Which whenever you hear, like, "Where are you going?" or "Where are you from?" you know, that's a Zen question. Where are we going? And Weka said, "Please go right ahead. That's it." Bodhidharma said, "If you go right ahead, you cannot move a step." Hearing this, Weka was greatly enlightened, had a real feeling of, oh, I get it. So another sort of intimate interaction from 1,000 years ago on the other side of the planet about seeing the potential for awakening in every moment, in every action. Hiking along together, but still considering, what is this walking? What is this place? What is this body? What is this? And being willing to challenge the other person's assumption about the reality of their living. That you might think that you are a person who is walking and getting somewhere, doing something in your life. A person over here with a goal that's over there. But maybe with that attitude, you're not going to get anywhere, really. Maybe there's potential for real liberation if you can let go of all of your plans. Don't try to go right ahead. Just take a step. And anyway, this text goes on to describe a little more, a few more qualities of their practice about Weka's career. And it says in there that, and who knows if any of this happened historically, but still it's great. It says that instead of establishing some kind of temple or monastery, Weka moved to the capital and lived there as a homeless person, just teaching and helping out where he could. It says that he would teach at wine shops and butcher stalls, which is like a little scandalous, you know, alcohol and meat. And it said that he would work with the outhouse cleaners, which I think means going along with a cart and a shovel, and going to each house or each business and shoveling the shit out of their outhouse, putting it on the cart, taking it out to the farms. Which I was reading actually a contemporary account of Zen training in Japan, and that was one of the jobs. They didn't have flush toilets. They would shovel out this shit and take it to a farm. A very detailed description about how they would balance the buckets and how you had to go pretty fast because you didn't have much time, but not too fast.
Long and too short.
and yeah, yeah. Have you read that?
He was the assistant to the Abbot Father.
Oh, you met him, huh? Jiryu?
Jiryu.
Jiryu, yeah, so you met that guy, yeah. Great book. A worthy talk to talk about his experience. And I one time got to do that. I learned a lot about aversion. It's a great practice to shovel shit. So anyway, back to Weka. So just real humility, you know, a real real commitment to ongoing training. He wasn't there just spouting off his mouth. He was there studying his mind, helping out as best he could. And maybe that way of living was Weka's response to Bodhidharma's instruction to cease all involvements and have no coughing or sighing in the mind. And finally, the story talks about radically accepting whatever circumstances arise in our life. And being a Zen story, it's a bit extreme. So it says that at one point, Weka was teaching outside the gates of a kind of a fancy temple and drawing a pretty good crowd. And the priest of the temple inside was upset by this, you know, as you would be. What's that guy doing? Probably pretty scruffy, you know. And so he denounced Weka as a heretic to authorities. In China, for thousands of years, have been fabulous about rules and bureaucracy, right? And what you're supposed to do and what you're not supposed to do. You know, you do the wrong thing, they shoot you. And that's what they did. Weka was arrested and executed. And the story goes that he did not resist or make a fuss or try to defend himself. I suppose he only had one arm. It's hard to get away. But, you know, it's implied that it was obviously futile. The authorities were convinced by the respectable other priest. So why make trouble? I think it would be misunderstanding to say that one should be passive in the face of injustice. So anyway, as winter practice period comes, I thought it'd be worthy to consider together some of these qualities from these old Zen stories. See, are there ways that we can put these teaching stories to use? To not think that these are fables and not really real, or that these were sort of superhuman people who are better than us, that we could never practice as deeply as them. But instead to just see what we can learn, how we can re-engage our life creatively with these stories of intimacy, humility, you know, courage, creativity, and most of all, just steadiness. You know, 10 years, 12 years, you know, 20 years, 30 years, steady practice. And so, what I thought we would consider together in small groups—I think groups of three—is what has been your experience to date when you try to add something? Do New Year's resolutions work? Is adding something or trying something new or trying to do something more strenuously, you know, when is that helpful? Or is there some quality or way in which you approach it that makes it more likely that it'll be useful to you? Or when is taking on anything extra just a disaster? You know, just another failure, another screw up, you know, another time you tried something and couldn't follow through. And maybe we could, ahead of practice period starting next week, think a little bit about how can I apply effort in a way that will benefit myself and others, you know, and so I don't just set myself up, you know, and you know, sometimes in the opening ceremony, we invite people to go around and everybody says kind of their plan, and there's always, and it might well be me or you, but there's always one or two people who makes this outrageous plan, you know what I mean? I'm going to sit 3 times every day, I'm going to study this, 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 and this, I'm going to work on this practice, I'm going to never raise my voice in anger, I'm never, you know. So one can overdo it, but one can also underdo it. You know, one can also act from fear and memories of past failures and trouble and not have confidence that you can actually change your life. You can live in a different way with a different attitude and a different approach. It's very possible to do that for 6 weeks. For one thing, you have the support of Sangha. Everybody else is making the same commitment with the support of the schedule at the Zendo and the retreats at the beginning, middle, and end of the time. Those are greatly supportive if you can make a few of those. But what's tricky about it, and in a way, you know, our lay practice is in a way quite a bit harder, I think, than the monastic practice where everything's sort of worked out for you, is we got to figure out how to add this to our life as it is. All of our other obligations and habits and tendencies. How can we create a little more space for practice and engage this in a positive way? All right, does that seem like a worthy thing to bring up? So could you please spread around the room and find yourselves two partners, so go group of three, and just sit together, and then I'll give a little more instructions about what to do next. And it's fun if it's somebody you don't know so well, too. I don't know if we have a divisible by three number, but we'll soon see. And you got to be not too close to the other groups so you can hear each other. So just kind of use the whole room.